Straight Talk About Vision Loss with Mark Riccobono.
This is a very special episode of Straight Talk About Vision Loss. In America today, there's a lot of talk about jobs and work, but there's one subject related to work that's not being talked about enough, and that's the subject of today's Straight Talk: equal work for equal pay for people with disabilities. Since the beginning of the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, it has been permissible to pay workers with disabilities less than the federally protected minimum wage. Today, we're going to talk about that subject, discuss some of the myths and misconceptions around that, and also talk about current legislation that will, once and for all, ensure that workers with disabilities have a right to receive equal pay for equal work, the protections that every American has right now, except for those with disabilities. So let's go talk about the future of civil rights and work for people with disabilities. All right, we are here with Anil Lewis, who is the Director of Strategic Communications for the National Federation of the Blind. Anil, welcome.
Good to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, and an important topic we have today, which is equal work for equal pay, fair wages for people with disabilities.
Yes, sir.
Before we talk about the current situation and maybe what we need to do about it, can you give us a little bit of the history of this issue?
Sure, I can. In 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed. That's the law that guarantees the fair minimum wage to every American citizen. I think right now it's at $7.25. But unfortunately, even though President Roosevelt, who signed this bill into law, was a person with a disability, he allowed for an exclusion. In the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's a section called 14C, which permits the legal payment of wages less than the federal minimum to all people with disabilities, meaning that people with disabilities are not guaranteed that same wage workforce protection as every other American citizen. And believe it or not, there are people with disabilities that are currently being paid pennies per hour.
And are these for-profit companies, non-profit, government agencies?
There's over 3,000 entities that have what's called a special wage certificate from the Department of Labor, which allows them to pay the less than the federal minimum wage. And of those, 8% of them are private entities, another 12% governmental and public agencies. But the largest percentage, of course, is the private, nonprofit entities that we've come to know and understand as being benevolent entities that provide opportunities for people with disabilities to experience the tangible and intangible benefits of work. Most notable are the Goodwills, the United Cerebral Palsies, the Easter Seals organizations. And let me be clear, I don't want to demonize them as organizations. They do good work. But and some of them have actually altered their business model, and they are paying their people with disabilities the federal minimum wage or more. But there are still those who have not evolved into this new world age of capability of people with disabilities and are valuing their employees with the federal minimum wage.
And I guess we should also be clear that there are some agencies that pay more than the federal minimum wage because they pay the minimum wage for their state. And in some cases, though, even those entities are still paying less than the federal minimum wage, which means the wage disparity in those organizations is even more significant.
You're absolutely correct. In a lot of instances where there's a federal requirement to pay an able-bodied person more than the federal minimum, you mentioned state minimum wages that are higher than the federal minimum, but also with governmental contracts, many of them also require the contracting entity to pay more than the federal minimum, $12, $14, $20, $24 an hour. But because it's legal to pay people with disabilities, even though they're employed in those same areas, they're paid less than the federal minimum.
So the underlying thought here is that people with disabilities are less productive.
That's correct. And I think that's what it really kind of boils down to as in regards to why the bill was passed. I think in 1938, most of the agricultural manufacturing, there may have been extremely limited opportunities. In addition, of course, the paradigm shift for America with respect to valuing people with disabilities had not occurred. And so maybe in 1938 it was necessary in a sense. But now today, assistive technology allows people with disabilities to do jobs that they weren't able to do in the past. There's a variety of different vocational rehabilitation strategies that are implemented to help even the most significant person with the most significant disability perform a job competitively, earning a competitive wage.
So how does this still stand today? I mean, why isn't it gone yet?
Well, you're just as aware as I am of the misconceptions and stereotypes that people with disabilities face. Society, moreover, and the majority of society still feels that people with disabilities need to be taken care of, that they don't have the capacity to be productive, participating members of our society, and they think that it's God's work to mm-hmm. create opportunities for them to be in a custodialistic environment, safe environment. So today we're fighting that myth and that stereotype, and many people with disabilities have already transcended that and become gainfully employed at competitive wages and in a variety of different careers. But for people with even more significant disabilities, that particular hurdle is a little harder to jump. Most recently, there was a hearing over on the Senate side, and it was all about the employment of people with significant disabilities. And there were individuals there that believed that people with disabilities still needed those lesser jobs. And in many instances, it's the parents who feel, you know, maybe some degree of guilt because, you know, our parents, sometimes they feel like it's their fault their child is born with a disability, but we recognize that disability is just a natural circumstance of life. But they've been told, taught to believe or led to believe that the low expectation for their children is the best that they can do. So mm-hmm. if they can get a job putting widgets together in a workshop, making pennies per hour, then that's a wonderful thing. So we know about, you know, the false expectations that are set for people with disabilities.
So we know that there's a misconception that people with disabilities aren't as productive. Because this is in the law, though, what protections are there to make sure that as the law stands right now, that people with disabilities aren't being exploited in these environments?
And that's a root problem of the current legislation. The law requires the Department of Labor, specifically the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, to investigate these entities that hold special wage certificates. And in our research, there's really no real protection. There are several GAO reports that show that when these entities are investigated, well, let me first start. Wage and Hour can really only investigate up to 10% based on their resources mm-hmm. of these entities per year. And of those in those GAO reports, when they have done investigations, on a regular basis, they find discrimination, wage discrimination. For example, because of the law, they're already able to pay a person with a disability, say, $3 per hour mm-hmm. rather than the federal minimum. When the Wage and Hour investigates them, it's shown that they paid the individuals $2 or $1 or pennies per hour. So these individuals who have already been subjected to the wage discrimination of being paid subminimum wages are paid even less than that, to the degree that there's billions of dollars of back wages sometimes, that millions of dollars, I'm sorry, I don't mean to overstate, millions of dollars of back wages that are due these employees with disabilities. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because Wage and Hour cannot investigate them in a timely fashion, many times the statute of limitations has passed. There's a 2-year statute of limitations to collect back wages. So these individuals who have been discriminated against primarily because they're paid subminimum wages, who've been overly discriminated against because they've been paid less than that, have no real recourse to even collect the back wages that they're due because the abuse is not found until it's too late.
And are there any efforts, significant efforts out there to look at the people with disabilities who are placed in some of these jobs and whether or not they're actually in the right job for their skill set?
I think that's a core problem to what's going on. I think that pervasively over the years, individuals have been employed in these shelter workshop environments, putting together widgets just to generalize, but no real consideration is given as to whether this meets their skill set. I was mentioning the Senate hearing earlier. There was a lady who testified at the hearing. Her name is Ruby Moore out of Georgia. And she was stating that there was a young lady who was deaf, blind, and also had an intellectual disability. That's the big three, not just one of them. She had all three. Mm-hmm. And she was considered so significantly disabled that even the workshops that employ people at subminimum wages, at pennies per hour, doing widgets, said that she's unemployable. We can't put her to work. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be her blessing, because what happened is Ruby and her team worked with this young lady. They did some hand-over-hand training. They did some self-esteem, some confidence building, and they helped this young lady find a job in her community working at a factory putting together harness. So she was working alongside able-bodied individuals, getting the same pay, getting the same benefits that they were getting. Now, had this not been the case, had these sheltered workshop entities thought that, okay, we'll put her to work, they would have put her to work putting widgets together, and she may not have been able to be productive in that environment, and she would have spent the rest of her life making subminimum wages, not being a part of her community.
And there are certainly examples of discrepancies in the way that people have been placed in these places of employment. I heard recently about one person who was told that they really needed to consider employment in one of these environments because they didn't have the manual dexterity mm-hmm. to be in competitive employment, mm-hmm. and a friend of his being told that it would be a great fit for one of these environments because he had superior manual dexterity.
Hmm.
So, not looking at the capabilities of the individuals, but actually just trying to put people in a place that seems to fit the employer better.
That's correct. And many of the entities that are paying people subminimum wages will state that, well, these persons deserve a choice. They don't work in this environment, they deserve to have that choice. But the unfortunate reality is, of the over 300,000 people that are currently employed in these environments, very few, if any, have really had a choice. Mm-hmm. And if you consider the choices working for subminimum wages or not working at all a choice, then, you know, maybe you can come to that justification. But the reality is many of these individuals are not exposed to the opportunities to engage in a competitive work environment at a competitive wage.
So a lot of people look at this issue and say, yeah, but we can't do any harm. We can't change this because it will harm some people with disabilities. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that that's kind of built on, one, the fear of change and people's inability to really see that there is a different reality for individuals that are currently in those situations. But the fact is, there's harm being done now that people don't want to acknowledge because it's painful. The reality is these individuals that are currently employed in these environments, one, are not being exposed to the training, opportunity, or supports to get out of those environments. The reality is 95% of them will remain there until, you know, they stop working. 5%, mm-hmm. only 5% of the individuals currently employed in that environment ever, I'd say, escape. Mm-hmm. The proper term, I guess, is transition, but I say escape because I think that it really is like a prison environment. And the reason that I say that is because the real harm that's being done, have you seen the movie called The Shawshank Redemption?
Yes.
Okay, it's all about the fundamental undertone of institutionalization. These are individuals in prison that have lived there for so long that when they get free, they can't cope, and mm-hmm. all they want to do is get back into prison. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what's happening to these individuals. They've come to know this as their reality. They've gotten so institutionalized that their whole psychology around what they can and cannot do has been altered to one so low that they are happy in this environment. And that's been proven. Many of the members of Congress that I've spoken to say if they visited these facilities and they see happy people, well, you know, that's kind of a natural kind of reaction to your circumstance. You want to be happy regardless of how adverse those circumstances are. But we want to expose these individuals to a better opportunity mm-hmm. because we believe that with the, well, let me correct that, we know that with the proper training and opportunity, natural supports, that these individuals can have a better reality.
So what can people do today to help with step one of this effort, which is reversing the support, the institutionalization for the custodial attitude that, that people with disabilities are less productive that's in the law now?
Well, we're addressing those on several fronts. The most prominent one is due to the courage of Congressman Stearns and Congressman Bishop. We have H.R. 3086 has been introduced. It's the Fair Wages for Workers with Disabilities Act of 2011, mm-hmm. which will phase out this provision over a three-year period. Once it's passed, this law will prohibit the Wage and Hour Division from issuing any new certificates, so there will be no additional entities that are allowed to exploit workers with disabilities. In the first year, the private entities that I mentioned earlier, the 8%, will lose their ability to employ people with disabilities at special subminimum wages. And this should be, you know, kind of a no-brainer. Individuals mm-hmm. are working for a competitive employer in a competitive work environment. They should be getting a competitive wage. In the second year, the governmental entities, the public entities that already have the requirement to pay, in many instances, higher than the federal minimum, a prevailing wage, much higher, will lose their ability to pay individuals with disabilities less than the federal minimum wage. We also believe that this will be a simple transition. Mm-hmm. Within the third year, the nonprofit agencies that have this ability will lose their ability. And this will probably be the most difficult challenge. But the reality is, as I said earlier, there are many, many institutions that have traditionally paid individuals with disabilities less than the minimum wage that have already made that transition. Most specific to us as an organization is, for years, the National Industries for the Blind paid blind people less than the minimum wage. And we continued as an organization to beat up on them and say, blind people have capacity. We add to the employer's bottom line. We should be paid a competitive wage. And they said, you know, just like others are saying now, well, we'll have to fire some people or we'll go out of business. And that's just not the reality. Mm-hmm. Of the 5,000 employees that are currently employed with the National Industries for the Blind, They say only 200. We still say, why the 200? Mm-hmm. But they say 200 of them are still not getting the federal minimum wage. Mm-hmm. But no one's lost a job. And indeed, the industries are more lucrative today than they were in the past. Mm-hmm. So we want to hold the other entities to that same standard, because it's been proven that if you adopt a new business model that values the employee with a disability, that your business can continue to be lucrative, and you can add you can put these individuals with disabilities in a quality work environment.
So HR 3086 is the current bill under consideration. Are there entities working with people with disabilities that are taking leadership and actually have already adopted very strong policies and practices that support paying everybody minimum wage?
Absolutely. We've just recently, and we're going to be collecting more, we just recently received a letter from a local agency here, BISM, which has employed blind people for years, and they have for years not allowed individuals to be paid less than the minimum wage. They have not they've chosen not to apply for or receive a special wage certificate from the Department of Labor, and they've been able to do that successfully. Also, most recently, the Chicago Lighthouse, who does have a special wage certificate, has stated to us that they have the certificate, but it's been a matter of administration, not a matter of use. Mm-hmm. Specifically, they have not used the certificate, meaning they haven't paid individuals with disabilities less than the minimum wage for years. So mm-hmm. they've sent us a letter also. So that's another aspect of what we're trying to do to move this forward. We're trying to identify other entities that have made this conscious business decision to value their employees with a fair minimum wage and have agreed to actually surrender their special wage certificates. And what we found is individuals, when you pay the person with a disability a fair federal minimum wage, then you become, that person also increases in their productivity.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to say about fair wages for people with disabilities?
I think that realistically, the biggest barrier we're fighting is the barrier that the National Federation has to fight on a regular basis. And that's the overall perception of people with disabilities as individuals who lack capacity. We recognize as an organization that that is a tremendous hurdle to jump, as I stated earlier. But we're committed to doing that. And we're counting on other individuals out there with disabilities, to assert their independence and their capacity. Individuals who know other individuals, who are looking for more and more of these win-win stories, mm-hmm. Like the young lady who had the deafness, the blindness, and the intellectual disability. There are other stories out there. It's unfortunate, though, that many of them are not in the forefront. I can also mention that now this issue has taken kind of ground. Many of the instances of exploitation are being brought to the forefront. Most recently, I think that was the catalyst of this whole discussion or debate was over in Alyssa, Iowa. There was a turkey farm mm-hmm. that employed 22 young men with intellectual disabilities. And this, I bring this out because the population of people with intellectual disabilities is the largest group of individuals that are currently being employed under the special wage certificates. Overwhelmingly, that's the population that people think they don't have the capacity. Well, these gentlemen working at this turkey farm were doing the same job that the able-bodied workers were doing. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, well, I maintain that they may have been doing some of the other jobs that the able-bodied individuals didn't even want to do. But the unfortunate fact is these individuals were not being paid the same wage. They weren't receiving the same benefits. They were receiving far less than the minimum wage. They were also, because they weren't making the minimum wage, eligible for Social Security benefits, which the employer became their rep payee, meaning he was collecting their Social Security benefits on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And he was really taking their Social Security benefit in payment for, quote-unquote, rent for this mm-hmm. building that they were living in. And the house was dilapidated. When this all came to light, they condemned the house. It was so bad. Mm-hmm. But all we're saying is that this, indeed, was a true example of the true exploitation, true enough, but it sets the standard high. But what we want to understand is the whole door was open when they allowed this entity to legally pay these individuals less than the minimum wage. That's mm-hmm. what started this whole abuse. And there are many examples of that across the country.
People may have more questions. They may want to know more about the issue or who is supporting HR 3086. Could you tell people what to do, how
sure.
they get a hold of you, that sort of thing?
Sure, absolutely. If you visit our website at www.nfb.org, you'll be steered to the most recent information about what's going on. We just recently published an article in our November Braille Monitor that kind of identifies the progressive effort in this arena. And if you want to contact me, I can be reached at the National Federation of the Blind The phone number is 410-659-9314. My extension is 2374. And my email address is alewis, that's A-L-E-W-I-S, at nfb.org.
Excellent. And you'd be happy to have stories that people have about where this is negatively impacting folks and
certainly
all that sort of thing.
We're really looking for more and more of the entities that have adopted the new business model,
mm-hmm.
Because we want to shame their peers and make them understand that, okay, it's not a matter of the capacity or perceived incapacity of the person with a disability. It's all about the acumen of the business representative. So if the business directors, managers, owners of other entities can do it, why can't these others?
And that's the real opportunity here, right, is when we get to the point where we don't have to be talking about sub-minimum wages, we can get to a robust dialogue of better practices to employ more people with disabilities and employ them in jobs that actually best suit their skills and abilities.
That's absolutely correct. That's really the sad irony of the legislation itself. It may have been passed to help create opportunities for employment people, to create employment opportunities for people with disabilities, but the reality is, because it's legal to pay people with disabilities less than the minimum wage, it reasserts every day that a person with a disability does not have the capacity to be a competitive employee. So that's the major misconception that prohibits or prevents people with disabilities from obtaining competitive employment. It's legal, meaning it's an affirmation. It's a false mm-hmm. affirmation, but it's still an affirmation that these people cannot be productive. We must eliminate that false perception in order for employers to have that paradigm shift of capacity. And then we can build on these best practices, these many examples of individuals with significant disabilities that have been competitively employed. And we just need to build on that.
Well, this has been great. I hope that it makes a difference in educating people about the opportunities to support fair wages for people with disabilities. Thank you, Anil.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
And hope that everybody takes this Straight Talk message about fair wages and helps to educate the public about the opportunities available by getting this bill passed and having a future dialogue about the real opportunities for employing people with disabilities. Thank you. During our dialogue with Anil Lewis about HR 3086, he referenced that there are organizations that are providing leadership on the issue of equal work for equal pay. He mentioned Blind Industries and Services of Maryland, and so I invited the president of BISM, Fred Puente, by to talk to us about the leadership issue around subminimum wages and equal work for equal pay for people with disabilities. Let's go talk to Fred. Great. We're here with Fred Puente. Fred, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Fred, we're here to talk a little bit about Blind Industries and Services of Maryland and about the leadership that BISM has shown in many areas, but in particular in the area of equal work for equal pay. But before we do that, can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of what is BISM?
Boy, Mark, that's hard to do in a thumbnail. But Blind Industries is an organization that creates opportunities and changes what it means to be blind for people in the state of Maryland and hopefully across the country.
Mm-hmm. And so you provide work opportunities.
Well, we have a full range. We have a full range of services, from a complete rehabilitation program mm-hmm. to manufacturing facilities, retail operations in 10 locations. We employ about 530 people in various operations around the country.
Okay, great. We've been talking a lot about the issue of equal work for equal pay, and in many places, this is a new idea. But at BISM, it's not a new idea, right?
No, sir, it's not. Blind Industries has always been committed to pay more than minimum wage to any of its associates. I've been associated with Blind Industries since 1987, and it's never been an issue. I think payment of minimum wage is a leadership issue more than an economic issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the wrong expectations, or if you don't understand the difference between capabilities and capacity, then as a leader, you're not doing your job, in my opinion. I can't, in my wildest dreams, think of a reason why you would want to pay somebody less than minimum wage. I really believe those people that do have the wrong expectations, and if they were in fact, would in fact pay minimum wage, their performance would improve.
Excellent. And that has shown in your experience over the...
At Blind Industries and Services of Maryland, we started in 1993 mm-hmm. in our current situation. Our sales were $7 million a year. We had a number of issues that we had to address and deal with. And today, however many years later that is, our sales are approaching $100 million. We have increased employment fourfold. And it's all been done by the people that are there. It's not mm-hmm. been done by me. All we've done is created an environment where people expect to perform and do, in fact, perform. It's about expectations, Mark.
Excellent.
If you're paying less than minimum wage, I don't know how you sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, you're talking about pennies. Mm-hmm. And if you were to invest that money in the people that you're working with to find ways to make them productive, you'd be way ahead of the game all the way down the line. The money you think you're saving paying less than minimum wage would be absolutely minimized when you see the performance that comes out of people's pride.
Makes to me, can't disagree at all. So you have not seen your experience, the productivity issue that is frequently claimed around paying subminimum wages, and is showing that a model of high expectations works. What's next for BISM? I mean, what are you going to do next to stay in the leadership role and continue to promote even greater opportunities for blind people?
What we intend to do, and we are doing, is we intend to continue to increase people's wages predicated on the performance of the organization. It's unique that you asked me that question now, because I haven't even announced this to our associates yet, but we are starting into a profit-sharing program at Blind Industries the first of the year that will involve everybody from the organization, who will all share equally in the profits of the organization. The leadership of our Board of Trustees has said everybody should share in the prosperity that is generated by those people that do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's critical that people understand how important it is that everyone be treated fairly.
And speaking of leadership, I know I've heard you speak about the fact that BISM is taking a hard look at leadership and how to make sure that more blind people have an opportunity to get into greater levels of leadership in the organization.
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that question. Did somebody pay you to ask that? As a matter of fact, we've just hired our first entrant into, for lack of a better word, we haven't given it a title yet, but a management development program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We've hired a young man who graduated from college, who actually started with us in our children's programs, went through the children, teenagers, and adult program, and has gone off to college, graduated, and come back, and is now in an orientation program at Blind Industries. And come the middle of December, he will go into a three-month assignment in one of our areas where he will, it'll either be sales or marketing or rehabilitation or human resources or administration or operations. Mm-hmm. He'll go through all of those areas and be exposed to those areas and see where his talents and his interests lie. And then at the same time, those leaders in those areas will be able to fight over how much they want to pay him and get him to come to work there. And we intend to expand that to as many people as we can bring on. Again, our Board of Trustees is committed to the development of leaders for the future, because that's what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And as someone who went through a national executive program in a major retail company, I can tell you that experience really helps to build a great understanding of an organization and also, as you say, to really find out what the person's made of and where their strengths and interests are. So I think that's commendable.
And I can't say it strongly enough, Mark. It's critical that they be involved in this process. You know, I can look at you and say, you know, Mark Riccobino looks like he could drive a race car.
Yeah.
But you may have no desire to do that.
Right.
You know, and it's a case of finding, every duck has a pond, and you have to find the one that excites that person.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see somebody that's excited about their job, minimum wage is never the discussion.
Yeah,
It really isn't, because they more than perform when they're doing something that they're excited about. And that's what we want to create. We want to create that excitement and bring leaders into the program and develop them so that they can take over and shout to the world that the opportunity is there.
Well, it'd be great, Fred, if we can shift the rest of the country's dialogue from away from the minimum wage question and into the leadership question.
It's my fervent prayer that we never have to have this discussion again.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time and also your leadership. So
thank you, sir. It's our pleasure.
That's Straight Talk about leadership and minimum wage for people who are blind. To wrap up our special Straight Talk about equal work for equal pay, we thought we'd go out on the street and ask people if they know about the fact that people with disabilities can be paid sub-minimum wages and about some of the leadership failures that are happening in this area. I think you'd be interested to see what the average person on the street knows or doesn't know about the issue of sub-minimum wages and how they feel about the practice.
I think it's a ridiculous idea.
I'm very shocked that corporations take advantage of it.
I've never heard anything about it till now.
Yeah, if they're doing the same job as a person without a disability, they should get paid the same thing.
It doesn't seem like it's fair to the individual.
I'm not surprised when I hear about organizations paying people with disabilities less money because they feel like they have to. But when the government says that it's okay to do that, I think that that's a huge problem. I think that's ridiculous. I don't think that that's right.
I don't think it's right.
No, it's not right.
It's not right.
No idea this was in place.
www.nfb.org 410-659-9314